Welcome to the Class of 1987 podcast. I am your host, Tim Harkness. On this podcast, we will be speaking with members of the Yale College Class of 1987 about their lives, where they've been, where they are now, and where they are going. We plan to cover a wide range of topics and have people who represent the full range of our class's experience. The class of 1987 is the best class that Yale College has ever had, and we're here to celebrate that. So sit back and listen to what your classmates have to say. So welcome to the next episode of the Class of 1987 podcast. With me today is Tamar Gendler. Welcome, Tamar.
Thank you so much, Tim. I'm really honored and delighted to be here.
Well, I'm so happy to have you. Briefly, could you just tell everybody what you're up to these days? You left for a while, but now you're back at Yale. So what do you do? You've been back for a while.
I am a New Haven resident. Every decade, I get drawn back here. So we all, as you know, graduated in 1987. We're the great class of 1987. And I managed to stay away from New Haven for a decade the first time round. But in 1996, when I finished my PhD, I was offered the opportunity to teach in the directed studies program. And so I came back to Yale, and my very first grown-up job after graduate school was teaching in the directed studies program and giving the political philosophy lecture course in Lindsley Chit 102, that room with the beautiful stained glass. So I taught at Yale that year. But my husband, as is often the case with academic couples, was employed at a different university. He was at Cornell. And our wonderful son, Laszlo, was conceived that year. And so by the end of that academic year, I was commuting with the steering wheel very far from the seat as Laszlo occupied more and more of the space in my body and in the automobile. So for about 10 years, I left Yale and I taught first at Syracuse and then at Cornell. And then in the fall of 2006, literally an exact decade later, my husband and I were both offered positions here at Yale. And I came back as professor in the Department of Philosophy, as chair in the program of cognitive science. And since then, I've had the opportunity to serve in a range of roles in support of the university.
So let me just stop you. For a while, you actually stopped being a professor and became a student again. Tell me about that. What was that about?
I would love to tell you about that. So I had the great honor of being offered something that the Mellon Foundation provides. The Mellon Foundation is a foundation that supports academic work and particularly projects in the humanities, and now is focusing on a number of really important issues of racial justice. But at the time, they offered a fellowship called a New Directions Fellowship, which basically paid you your salary to be a full-time student for a full year.
So what classes did you take, and did it change your direction?
It did change my direction. So I found out about the fellowship, which I had in 2010. I found out about it a year beforehand. So I started to prepare for the year of being a student, actually the spring semester before the fellowship. And I took a course called Computational Methods in Cognitive Science, which reintroduced me to computing, which is something that I hadn't done in 20 years. So in the spring of the year before I took the year off, I took this computing course. And then I went to the University of Pennsylvania for a special summer school called Neuroscience Boot Camp, which was a school for lawyers and professors and other individuals who wanted to learn intensive neuroscience techniques and skills over a couple-week period. And then I came to Yale, and I had this New Directions Fellowship, and I had, at the time, been the chair of the cognitive science program. I was interested in the connections between philosophy and psychology, but I was reading a lot of articles that I felt like I only partially understood. So my original goal was to be able to understand the bulk of articles that I cited in footnotes. And then I realized that most co-authors of articles don't even understand every sentence of them. So my goal became to be able to fully understand the abstract of any piece that I was citing and the pluses and minuses of the techniques that had gone into it. So I took a bunch of courses in the psychology department, including one where I learned how to do fMRI work. I followed the second year psychiatry curriculum at the medical school, and I learned how our psychiatry residents are trained. I took a course on cognitive behavioral therapy. I took a course on statistics with the advanced students in psychology. And for all of the courses that were undergraduate courses, I made sure that one of my advisees was also a student in the class so that I would be held to task on getting the homework
done. Did that work?
It was absolutely fabulous.
What was it like being a student who had been a professor and going back to a student to sit with undergraduates?
It was absolutely wonderful. It really changed my sense of the importance of certain kinds of structural pedagogical features.
Well, wait a second. You just said a lot.
Let me say a lot of words. Let me say some words in English. It made me realize people care about when assignments were due. That is, when you're on the other side of the podium, you have a full sense of the class and its narrative structure. You have a real idea of where you're going, so you know what the whole road ahead looks like. And you get sometimes this feeling that, oh, if I swapped these two lectures, the class would go better. Or if I changed this assignment, the class would go better. From the perspective of the student, that's enormously disconcerting. If you don't know where the class is going, it's really unnerving to have an assignment date change or a set of topics get switched. And I became much more aware of the asymmetry in knowledge between the person teaching and the person being taught, which was incredibly valuable in how it changed my own teaching.
Did it change the way, did being a student again, an undergraduate student, change the way you present information?
Absolutely. In every way, I will say there were two main things that came out of that fellowship program. One was the way in which I changed my own teaching, and I'll talk about that. The second is that when I became dean, I introduced this possibility of taking a semester and being a full-time student to all faculty in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. And I received a generous gift in support of this. And Yale is now the only place where every fall and every spring, five faculty are given their full salary. And instead of teaching classes, they enroll in whatever classes they want. So they could be a physics professor and take philosophy classes. They could be a literature professor and take a computer programming class. They could be a professor of German and go and learn another language. So I introduced that. And what it means is that in the course of a decade, 100 of the faculty will have engaged in this kind of program. And it's producing already extraordinary pedagogical innovations and people with a real sense of what it is to be in the classroom. In my own case, after I did the New Directions Fellowship, I composed a course which stands now on the Open Yale Courses website, which was called Philosophy and the Science of Human Nature. And the plot is Dead Guy Tuesday, Cog Sci Thursday. It's about multiple paths to wisdom. It's about how something that Plato or Aristotle said can be represented in contemporary idiom in the form of neuroscience research or game theoretic representations. So every Tuesday, you read something by somebody old and dead. So you might read an excerpt from the Iliad or the Odyssey. And on Thursday, for example, we read an extraordinary work called Achilles in Vietnam, Odysseus in America, which was about post-traumatic stress disorder in veterans of the Vietnam War as read through the Iliad and Odyssey.
Super interesting. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Do you think people learn more as a student in a class or as a professor?
That's a great question. So I learned a huge amount as a professor pretending to be a student. So one of the things I did in the lecture course is that I realized that lots of readings that I thought would be accessible weren't accessible to students. So I put together reading guides for each of the readings and crucial terms and concepts. I learned that I needed to do that because I had been a student in the class. But I would say figuring out how to present information that is obvious to you to people to whom it is not obvious is the best way to learn material. I learn every time I teach, including when I teach in directed studies, which are texts that I've taught dozens and dozens of times.
Interesting. Yeah, I actually find the same thing because that's what I do for a living is I present information to people who don't know it.
Yes.
You really have to learn it. And you know if you know it, if you can explain it.
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right.
So going back to your cross-pollination between philosophy and cognitive science in the real world, because I know you have a couple open courses, which everyone should take, I will add. How are you thinking about what philosophers, philosophy, including the ancients, or maybe especially the ancients, can tell us about this time in history, the pandemic, everything we're going through? How do you think about it?
I think philosophy gives us a number of tools, one of which is the ability to abstract from the particular and think about what the common structures are. And one of the things that I find incredibly useful about having been trained as a philosopher is that I think about things in terms of their conceptual structure. But the second thing that philosophers give us is a reminder of the commonality of the human experience. I went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art yesterday, and we were walking through the Egyptian section. And there are these incredible dioramas of daily life in the Egyptian world that are 4,000 years old. One where they're slaughtering cattle and one where they're mixing grain. And then there's some where they're riding on ships. Absolutely extraordinary artifacts. And you realize that the human experience has been common for as long as it has been represented in ways that we can learn from. That is, the material culture that these artifacts are, the philosophical works in the Western tradition, the philosophical works in the East Asian traditions, all of these converge on telling us life is really challenging, that the human experience that is basically defined by its finitude. There's a moment of coming into being at birth. There's a moment of leaving being at death. And the moments in between are about how one creates meaning and experiences the richness of the world. So what ancient philosophy gives us is two things simultaneously. One, a rigorous conceptual framework. Two, a feeling of common humanity.
Yeah, I was doing some reading, and I'd like to just read from a speech you gave, a welcoming speech to entering first-year class in 2017. So you talk about contradictions that the students are going to face during their time at Yale. And I'm just going to read two paragraphs and then ask you to comment. So you suggest that they have a little piece of paper in their pocket, figuratively, that they can refer to. And you say, that's why you need that little piece of paper in your pocket, the one that says, assume that my perspective is mine alone. Sometimes using we is a way of being inclusive. We are all in this together. But sometimes it's a way of tacitly excluding. We think thus and such, or we feel so and so. That we, like this room, may have different meanings for different people. So take that piece of paper from your pocket when you are trying to genuinely listen and genuinely speak. Realize that you may be assuming commonality when there is actually diversity, that you may be assuming consensus when there is actually dissent. Open yourself to the possibility that there are novel perspectives to be gained from your classmates, from the historical works you read, from the multiple disciplines that provide you with differing approaches to questions that matter. If your perspective is yours alone, there is much to be learned from the perspective of others. First of all, completely agree. That's why we're doing these podcasts, because I want to hear about the perspectives So there's this commonality, but there are all those differences. How do you square the two? And how do you think about those competing ideas, the contradiction of what you just talked about with the sentiment you expressed to the first years in 2017? Like, how do you square that?
Wow. Thank you, Tim. So that was an address called Keeping Contradiction in Your Pocket. And the piece of paper was drawn from the rabbinic tradition. And on one side, it says, for me alone was the world created. And on the other side, it says, basically, I am but dust and ashes. And those are the two perspectives you need to hold simultaneously. The idea for the paragraph that you read actually came to me from the Passover Seder. So excuse a little digression to something about the four children at the Passover Seder, because I think it will end up being an answer to your question. So the Passover Seder is the retelling of the liberation of the Jewish people from Egypt. And it's a ritual structure that includes lots of segments that are read aloud. And one of them is a segment called the Four Children, which describes four different personality types that children might have and asks you to tell the story of the redemption from Egypt to each of them. And one of the child's children is a wise child, one is a wicked child, one is a simple child, and one is a child who doesn't know enough to ask. Interestingly, you give exactly the same answer to the wise child and to the wicked child, but the way that they interpret it differs. The answer you give is, it is because of what the Lord God did for me when I was redeemed from Egypt. And the wise child interprets that as inclusive, and the wicked child interprets it as exclusive. That is, the wise child says, ah, it was done for you, hence it was done for all of us. The wicked child says, it was done for you, hence it was not done for me. And so the little paragraph that you read aloud, we as inclusive versus we as exclusionary, is a pair of mindsets that we have to navigate the world. And we can run through evolutionary reasons that that would be the case. We can run through sociological reasons that that would have to be the case. But the capacity to flip between the recognition that your perspective is unique, hence you always have something to say, and everyone's perspective is unique, hence everyone else always has something to say, is, I think, the fundamental skill that we seek to imbue in our students.
Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you're enjoying the conversation. Please remember that this podcast is being brought to you by the 35th reunion of the greatest class Yale College has ever known, the great class of 1987. Our reunion will be in New Haven, Connecticut, June 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th in Pearson College. We hope to see you there. Now, back to the conversation.
And I find it interesting coming to reunion and doing these podcasts because we spent this time together close to each other. And a lot of times people say we have a shared experience, but at the end of the day, we have a shared temporal experience and a shared spatial experience. Sometimes we took the same classes, so we took the same texts. And my guess is, even if you didn't take the same version of English 129, you all have read many of the same books. But the way our classmates have taken from that experience has a lot of similarities, but there's some huge differences. And also, the lesson that people take from the same experience is hugely different, how they've interpreted it, how they put it into place. And that, if I had a wish, and I do have a wish about reunion, it's that we actually come together and talk about this stuff. I think it's this shared experience, but at the same time, difference is what makes the whole experience much more interesting.
And one of the striking things about people you knew when you were young is that it gives an unawkward, appropriate intimacy to conversation. So with family members whom you have known all your life, there is, as we all know, a certain kind of ease and intimacy as the result of shared experiences, but also as the result of there being a kind of social permission where there's nothing inappropriate about talking about deep and important things with someone with whom you shared a living space. And Likewise, there is an opportunity to connect in deep ways to people who are radically different from you now through coming to a reunion, because all of us understand that it is both instinctively and socially permissible to have a really sincere, open, vulnerable conversation with someone who knew you a long time before.
I think that that is right. But like some families, there is dysfunction. And I think that trying to deal with some of the dysfunction in our class and our shared experience will be part of the reunion. And I think there's no escaping it. I hope we can have healing and thoughtful conversation about the issues our class faces.
Absolutely. And I didn't mean either in talking about the class or in talking about families to suggest that they aren't also spaces where we have the most profound feelings of contention, where the hurt of exclusion at a moment in life where you are making yourself into the person you will be lasts. And so these moments, we were 18 years old, 17 years old when we got here. And we did all sorts of clumsy things that hurt one another. And all of us were in a process of self-creation. And so those are very, very deep in the self. They're like things that get on every single one of the Xerox copies. They're like an early stage in a cryptocurrency. So they get reproduced throughout the entire chain.
I think that that's absolutely correct. I have one incident in mind. Looking back on it now, it's a thing that stuck with me for a long time. And when I finally talked to that person again, I realized that they were coming from the same sort of insecure place I was coming from. And it was a really awkward attempt to connect and didn't mean offense. And it took me 30 years to figure that out. And I think that kind of realization comes with time, I hope. And, you know, there are others, I believe, think that there are some things that are irredeemable, and still, can we have a conversation about how we move together as a class to, or just as contemporaries, to help each other have a fruitful and fulfilling remainder of our life? Because I wouldn't want to go through life with a grudge or, you know, bad feelings from that time if they're completely unresolved.
Yeah, that's a lovely thought about the reunion.
Anyway, switching gears a bit, you are not just a dean and a professor, but you are also a mother. You've mentioned your son. How many kids do you have?
I have two fantastic, wonderful children. A son who graduated from Yale at my kitchen table in the spring of 2020, and a daughter who is a first-year student in Pauli Murray College.
Very exciting. And how has your journey as a mother informed your journey as a thinker and a professor?
I used to say when I started in academic administration that there were only two skills that I needed. One were the set of skills that I had acquired as a debater for the Yale Debate Association, and the other were the set of skills that I had acquired as a parent. That is, the sort of pastoral role, the role of recognizing both responsibility and the autonomy of the individuals with whom you're interacting, has been just central to my time as an administrator. So that's the metaphoric sense in which it's been important to me. The literal sense in which it's been important to me is that I have two of the most extraordinary people in the world who grew up in my house. I have an extraordinary life partner, my husband, Zoltan, who has been their parent, and each of the children has had a life journey that has taught me a lot about how complex the world actually is.
And what have they taught you?
So my son was dyslexic and was a complete non-reader until the age of 9. In fact, my daughter, who was 3 when my son was 9, was a stronger reader at 3, before she had ever gone to school, than my son was in 4th grade. But my son is brilliant in numerous other ways. And for a house that was built on books and reading and the culture of literacy. It was an incredible experience to learn how to appreciate the multiple forms of brilliance that my son had that had nothing to do with texts.
That must have been very difficult for him.
It was extraordinary, actually. We had lived in Ithaca, New York, and in Ithaca, there's a politicization of the learning to read literature such that phonics, which is what you need if you are dyslexic, is considered to be a right-wing denial of the liberation of children.
Yeah, and I didn't think Orton Gillingham would be the kind of thing
yes,
that
you
would,
think
would
that
cause.
Would was there with creationism, but there it is.
Yeah.
So my son was only given proper training in learning to read when he was already 9, when we moved to New Haven. And he had actually an incredible Orton Gillingham tutor that ended up working with him every single morning from the age of 9 till the age of 12. And even during summer vacation, that is what he did from 7 to 8. And he graduated from Yale University as a history major. So that speaks pretty well to what the training was able to do for him. He's an incredibly charming, outgoing person. He's gone into political campaign work. He's worked in Mississippi and Louisiana and Montana and also on some of our more local elections. And he's in Budapest right now. He's bilingual in Hungarian. And so he's in Hungary for a couple of months with my in-laws. My daughter is another extraordinary person. I'm extremely proud of my kids, as you can hear. She is somebody who is simultaneously a great reader of literature. She's in the directed studies program, but she's also very adept in mathematics. And so she's taking an advanced computer science course in cognitive science. But the most interesting thing that my daughter taught us was about self-knowledge. So when she was 3, she still went by her birth name, Jonah, when she was born in a fully male body. And she was given the name Jonah at birth. And when she was 3 years old, it became evident to us that she had a non-standard gender identity. So she wore dish towels on her head. She would have a sort of cocktail party effect at the word she. She wore clothing in colors that is associated with girls. She played with dolls. She liked pink plastic purses. And she was an altogether delightful, happy child. And she went to an elementary school here in New Haven, which was fully ready to have a boy named Jonah who wore dresses and long hair. And so from the age of 3 till the age of 9, she lived very happily as a boy named Jonah, who expressed himself in ways that are typically associated with females. And we were really well supported in this journey. We participated in an annual summer gathering called Camp I Am, which was written up in the New York Times. There's an incredible photo series about it. And so Hannah met lots of other kids like her, people who were boys who had a gender identity that looked female. And then at the age of 9, it became obvious to her that male puberty wasn't something that she was comfortable going through, and that given the social construction of gender, 2 of the 3 things about her at that point could align, but not all 3. And at the time, her pronoun and her body aligned, and her self-presentation didn't. That is, she used the pronoun he, she had a body that is associated with being male, but her self-presentation, she wore dresses, she had long hair, and prepubescently, she looked exactly like a young girl. All of her social network were girls. All of her friendship structures were built in the way that are typically associated with. And she decided to switch the alignment so that her pronoun would match her gender identity, even though her body didn't. And she made that decision, and at the time was a very devoted attendee of a spectacular Jewish summer camp called Camp Eisner, where she had attended as a boy named Jonah who wore dresses for 4 years. And the summer before fifth grade, she wanted to go back to camp, but given that she was now Hannah, needed to go back to camp in a way that would allow her to live in a girl's bunk. And we worked with an incredible Jewish organization run by a Yale graduate named Edith Klein. It's an organization called Keshet. And Keshet helped us compose a letter to the fellow summer camp parents that said, like other girls her age, Hannah is private about the way her body differs from those of her friends. And we sent that letter out, and every parent who received it requested that Hannah be in their daughter's bunk. And she went back to Eisner for another 4 years as Hannah and lived happily.
And it just didn't matter.
And it was just her same set of friends and her on the other side of the hill.
Terrific. Well, that's really an uplifting story. So how do you know when you've done a good job as a teacher or as a parent? How do you think about that when you look at the children as they go, now no longer children, go into the world, both your students and your children? How do you think about that?
So my son and I were talking. He's got a wonderful new girlfriend. And I asked him what he liked most about her. And he said, I like most that she brings out my kindness. And I thought, that is an example of having successfully parented, that what he looks for in another person is that it helps him to be kind. In my students, my goal is to introduce them to the capacity to feel comfortable with learning about the world in a particular way, so that you introduce people to ancient texts and you say, here's a whole body of knowledge. Here's a whole set of lived experiences. Here's a whole bunch of other first-person perspectives. And I'm giving you the tools and skills to allow you to enter that different world. Or if I teach a technique in logical representation, or I teach some fact from game theory or neuroscience, the goal is to give somebody a tool for making sense of this incredibly complex, incredibly interesting world that ultimately can be made sense of only by making use of all of the tools that the liberal arts provide.
So now we've gotten to the point of our podcast where we go to the lightning round. So I'm going to ask you some short answer questions.
Go for it.
What class, either one you've taken or one you've taught, has actually taught you the most?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. The class that I learned the most from, or the class that redirected me the most, was actually a course that I took freshman year with Phil Bricker, and it was called The Philosophy of Space and Time. And when I went into that course, I thought I wanted to be a math major. And when I came out of that course, I knew that I wanted to study philosophy. And it changed me because it caused me to realize what I think I have spent the rest of my life doing, which is recognizing that the way to make a problem tractable is to approach it from as many different directions as you can.
What do you do for fun?
I do three sorts of things for fun. One is that I go hiking in the incredible beauty of New Haven and its areas around it. The second is that I do ridiculous, inept craft projects with my daughter. And the third is that I love cooking things that have lots and lots of steps.
That sounds great. Final question. What part of New Haven should classmates explore when they come back? What food should they eat? What should they see? What's new, or what's new if you look at it from a more mature angle?
Great question. So there are three fabulous new food neighborhoods for our students to explore. One is Westville, which is what you get to if you go straight west from campus up Whaley Avenue. One is Ninth Square, which is what you get to if you go straight east from campus on Chapel. And one is the neighborhood in East Rock, straight to the north, which you get to if you go north on State Street. And I am happy to give a guided tour of all three neighborhoods to anybody who comes to Pearson in person.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. Really, it's been great talking to you.
Absolutely a pleasure, Tim. Thank you. You're a spectacular interviewer.
Thank you.
In a world where people were isolated by a pandemic, forced to live their lives remotely in an endless parade of Zoom meetings, one Yale College class dared to break the mold. The Yale College class of 1987 is planning what no Yale College class has ever tried before, at least not for a while. An in-person reunion, June 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th, 2022. We will be gathering in Pearson College. Be there for engaging discussions, nightly revelry, and way too much New Haven pizza, if there ever could be such a thing. We'll wrestle with age-old questions like, maybe I look better in a mask, what do you think? Who or what is a Bula? What in the world am I going to do with no kids in the house? These questions and more will be answered at our 35th college reunion. Be there. It's one Yale College class dared to break the mold. That's it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been the Y87 podcast, the official podcast of the greatest class that Yale College has ever known. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments or questions or would like to appear as a guest, please email me at timothy.p.harkness@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Such a thing. We'll wrestle with age-old questions like, maybe I look better in a mask. What do you think? Who or what is a Bula? What in the world am I going to do with no kids in the house? These questions and more will be answered at our 35th college reunion. Be there. That's it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been the Y87 podcast, the official podcast of the greatest class that Yale College has ever known. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments or questions or would like to appear as a guest, please email me at timothy.p.harkness@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you.